Hi, my name's Rusty, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Rusty.
Today I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope with you, or my hope, faith, and courage. And I'm going to, you know, tell you first of all, a little disclaimer. This is how I remember it, so it's my truth. It might not be the way that it was, but it is how I remember it, so it's my truth. And with that, I was born 1962, June 12th. I'm 53 years old. My clean time date is January 16th, 1989. So when I look back at my life and I think about my childhood, addiction was part of my life before I even realized it. I mean, there's pictures of me sitting on, well, pretty much all of the kids. I come from a family of six, older brother, older sister, two older brothers, me, and then a younger sister. And there's probably a picture of every one of us on either our mother or father's lap with a bottle of Pabst Blue Ribbon in our mouth, you know. So I remember getting up early mornings on a Saturday after my parents had a Friday night party and looking for all the half-drinking beers and chugging them until you got that one that they use as an ashtray. But that did not deter me from doing that. Like I said, I had two older brothers that were 2.5, 3 years older than me, and they thought that it was really funny to give Rusty a beer and watch him throw up. You know, and that was part of my story back then. I mean, they'd go out and they'd be drinking, they'd, "Here, Rusty, have one." And I would throw up. This was before the age 11. At 11 years old, I was in Kosciuszko Park, and a friend of mine had some pot, some marijuana, three real thin joints of some Colombian, and man, I smoked three of those, and I didn't get sick. And I was like, all right, here we go. So from there, you know, there's other things that happened early in childhood that, you know, when I look back at it, showed me that I had that addictive personality. My father had this company picnic where there was all you could drink soda. And I drank soda until I threw up. I mean, that's what I know. That's what I knew. I found out years later my brothers were hitting the beer tap and drinking that until they threw up. But that's, you know, that's part of my story. You know, the neighborhood that I grew up with, drugs and alcohol were part of it. It was part of what we did. It was part of my family, socializing. And as I hit high school, things just got worse. I got busted for possession my freshman year of high school. I had probably enough for a joint. It was Friday night before intramural basketball. So I got arrested, taken to jail, and I sat there. And I was with five other guys, and each one of my friends got picked up. I saw them parents, because there was just a little square window in this cell. And I sat, and I sat, and I sat. And it's 1 o'clock in the morning. And finally my dad showed up. And apparently my brother had to talk him into coming get me. He wanted me to sit and learn my lesson. And back then, I got, you know, I thought 9 months of probation, and that was it. Funny thing about it is that my parents sent me to a Lutheran, like, weekend retreat the next weekend, part of my punishment, and there I ran into a guy with some weed. So, you know, high school was a blur. You know, from that getting busted, I had just a little bit of weed on me. By the time I got back to school on Monday, because it didn't happen on school property, I didn't get suspended or expelled or anything like that. But by the time I got back to school on Monday, I had been busted with a quarter pound of weed. So now everybody's coming to me to buy weed. It's like, great, you know. And there, you know, just progressed my addiction, you know. Pills, speed, acid. I think it was like 17... close to my 18th birthday when I first tried cocaine. And, you know, in the beginning it was just a weekend thing when I could afford it. And I hadn't run into this friend of mine that I grew up with. I've known him my whole life. And I hadn't seen him for quite a few years, well, maybe a year and a half or so, because him and my brother had gotten into a fight. I'm not quite sure what that was all about, but I hadn't seen him. And I was working at Kmart in the automotive department, and he came in. He was getting something for his truck, and he said he was having a party. So why don't you stop by? He gave me his address, and after work, I went over, and he sat me down and in a chair. He says, here, you got to try this. This might date me a little bit, but back then we called it Freebase. And I smoked that, and that was it. That's all she wrote. That's what I wanted to do. I found it. And from there, it just progressed. Girlfriends at the time, you know, I usually tried to date bartenders because then I could always drink free. And even back then, looking back at it, you know, I realized that, you know, possibility of a problem with alcohol, because we'd go out and get drunk and it's like, oh, let's go get some coke and get straight. Okay, well, we'd be walking out of the bar and guys leaving half drinks on the bars. You gonna finish that? So I'd be slamming their drinks before we left, you know. And then a girlfriend of mine had a girlfriend that came back from California, and she wanted to smoke some coke, and I brought all this stuff to do the Freebase, and she freaked out and showed me how to co-base crack cocaine. And it just progressively got worse and worse from there. There was a time in my life where another guy and I were sitting in a girlfriend's house. His girlfriend and the girl I was seeing at the time got up and were going to work, and we had been up for a couple of days, and they got to get up and they're like, what the hell is wrong with you? And it's like, the thing popped in my mind is like, we're addicts and we're good at it, you know. So it was really easy for me to accept that, you know, I was an addict, and that was something that I knew. You know, from there it just progressed. Jobs gone. You know, and had it not been for my mother, I would have been on the streets. There's no doubt about it. The last part of my using I remember is moving in with my mom and selling my car for dope. And here's, you know, the things that I knew about treatment or recovery was a buddy of mine who had gone into DePaul. And it was something that you went to stop using for a little while, you know, get it out of your system. And many a times we picked him up and went right to the bar and got drunk and then got some coke. And so I really didn't know anything about this program at all. And this friend would come in to me and preach to me. What I heard was preaching, and I didn't want any part of it. But I was living with my mom, sold my car. I had been up for a couple of days, and out of the blue, he calls me on a Saturday morning. I don't believe I talked to him in weeks or even months. And he called me up, and he said that his truck died. He was at a meeting the night before. His truck died, and could I come out and give him a jump? And it's like, well, I got to ask my mom and see if I could use her car. So I asked her. She said, yeah. I went out, and I met him, and I jumped his truck. And, you know, like I said, I'd been up for a couple of days, and I hadn't eaten. And he said, you want to get some breakfast? And we went for some breakfast, and for the first time, I heard him talk to me because I was ready. I had gotten to a point where, you know, rewinding just a little bit, the Friday night before he called me, I was sitting in my room alone, spiritually bankrupt and just totally desolated because of my life. And I said a simple prayer. It was, God, I just don't want to live like this anymore. And I know that he heard that prayer. You know, rewinding just a little bit further back, on New Year's Eve, January 1989, you know, I hung out with a lot of shady characters, should I say? So, you know, a lot of the guys, I don't even really know their real names at this point. There was Big John, Little John, Hogjaw, Elf. They all had different names. And this guy, Elf, his dad was a steam pipe fitter. And he had just gotten his journeyman's card for steam pipe fitting. And he had a nice Nova. He had a bike. He had a nice apartment. And his girlfriend went out and didn't come home New Year's Eve. He went to his dad's shop, and with a bar of soap, he wrote, "I have nothing to live for," hooked up a hose to the exhaust, and killed himself. Now, that hit me really hard because I didn't have a job. I was living to use and using to live, and that was my life. And this guy I'm looking at, he's got a decent car, he's got a decent living, he's got a motorcycle, and he's got nothing to live for? What the hell do I have? You know? And it just, this happened with my friend with the jump about 14 days later. So, fast forward to that meeting with him, and it's like, you know, let's do it. I need help. I just, what can you do for me? I'm ready. And he said, go home, pack a bag, and I'll come get you. Okay, I'll give you a call when I come get you. Well, something happened with his daughters that night, and he couldn't come and get me. And he said that he would be over first thing Sunday morning. I said, okay, well, my mom worked really early. She left the house at around 4:30. And 5 o'clock in the morning, I hear a... Now, my room was upstairs, and I didn't want to miss him because I didn't want to live like this anymore. So I slept on the couch, and I heard that little knock on the door. And I went to it, and it was a buddy of mine that I had pretty much used with to my end. He had a package, and that was it. We were off. Now, you got to understand something. I had said that prayer, I just don't want to live like this anymore. But I couldn't do it. All it took was that, because I didn't have any steps, I didn't have any principles, I didn't have any of this in my life. I couldn't do it by myself. So at some point through that course with him, because we were going out the whole day, and I just said, I can't do this, I'm going home. And my friend called me, picked me up, went to his house, and you know, drank some alcohol to try to come down a little bit. And he's trying to get me into a treatment center, and I'm sitting in his house out on Racine Avenue, and I'm like, God, do I really want to do this? Is this really something that I want to do? And I look on a shelf, and there's a Bible. So I pick up the Bible, and I say, okay, show me. And I let the Bible drop open. And it opened up to Isaiah chapter 6, and this is what it said. In the year of the king Isaiah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Above it stood the seraphims. Each one had 6 wings, with twain that he covered his face, and with twain he covered his feet, and with twain he did fly. And one cried unto another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the posts of the door moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. Then said I, Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Then flew one of the seraphims unto me, having a coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from off the altar. And he laid it upon my mouth, and said, Lo, this has touched thy lips, and thine iniquity is taken away, and thy sin purged. Also I heard the voice of the Lord, saying, Whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Then said I, Here am I, send me. And I didn't have to read any further. I knew what I had to do. Got into Waukesha Memorial that day. Got into the Lawrence Center after 2 days of detox after that. Now here's one of the things is that I found out that later that my brother had started going to meetings and some type of outpatient treatment, I believe, and on the 10th of January. That all happened on the 14th. I got into treatment 16th, and neither one of us told each other about it because we still wanted to drink beer and smoke weed with each other, you know? We just wanted to get the coke out of our lives. So once I was in treatment, I had a 30-day stay, and the education that I got in there was that, you know, I had to take a hard look at how I used everything, alcohol, everything, people. So I was in that treatment center 3 days, and I just got the itch. I just needed to get out. So when they said, you know, if you feel like that, come to the counselor. So I went to my counselor, and I said, look, I just got to get out of here. I just got to go. He goes, really? Okay, well, let's talk that through. Where would you go? How would you get out of here? Well, I called Dave. Dave would come and get me for sure, you know? I took him shit when he was up in the hospital. I'm sure he'd come out here and bring me some stuff, you know? And he was like, okay. So Dave comes out and gets you. Then you go, and then what? Well, then we get some dope, and we smoke, and we, you know? And then what? Well, we get some more. Okay, fast forward the tape. You've done everything you can do. You've all the means that you can or have to get stuff. Can't do any more. You're all done. How do you feel? And it took me back to that day when I was in my room and I said, God, I just don't want to live like that anymore. And I don't ever want to have that feeling again, ever in my life. And he said, what are you willing to do for your recovery? And I said, whatever you tell me to do, just tell me to do, because I just, my best ideas on how to live life got me here. So tell me what to do. So with that, you know, I started working a program. I started reading everything that I could get my hands on. An old timer came into the treatment center for one of the day meetings and started a meeting out with, take a look around. There was 20 of us in treatment. So take a look around. In a year, there'll only be 2 of you here. I was like, that hit me hard. 20 of us, there's only going to be 2 of us. He says, that those are the statistics. 2 of you, out of 1 out of 10. And he said, the bad news is you got to change everything you know about living life. The good news is you don't have to do it all today. So I took that to heart, and I started reading everything that I could. You know, there was people in the treatment center that were there for their 3rd and 4th treatment, and relapse became something that was talked about. Every bit of information that I could find on relapse, I grabbed and I read. Every bit. Because I did not want to be that statistic. I just didn't want to do it. I didn't want to go back to that way of living. It was just too insane and too ungodly. You know, one of the things that you know, I talked about is the way that I drank and the way that I used. I mean, when I got to that point where I didn't want to live anymore the way that I was living, I thought that I was insane. I truly thought that I was insane. So when I saw that second step and I saw a way back to my sanity, I thought, amen. And for the first time in a long time, I got down on my knees and I prayed. And God has always been part of my life. We went to a Lutheran grade school, pre-kindergarten. The other part that's been part of my life is singing. I love to sing. I've been in bands. I've been singing since pre-kindergarten all the way through high school and got into bands. And that was part of my trouble, too. You know, I got into bands, and it was all sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know. And that led to some crazy stuff. But, you know, and I did try singing after I got into the program and got clean. Inevitably, you know, I'd tell them, hey, I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't care what you guys do, you know. And first practice would be great. Second practice, somebody would hand me a joint or a bowl, and it would be like, I can't do this anymore. And then I got involved with the church. I was leading worship, praise and worship. I was the leader of the praise and worship team, singing. I did that for 10 years, and that was just incredible. The relationship that I have with my God today, and this is my story, so that's what I talk about. You know, if you don't, or if you can't grasp the spiritual concepts of this program, man, you need to find a sponsor that does. You need to find somebody that does that can help you with that. Because without it, you're not going to get it. You're going to lose it. I've seen it happen lots of times. My brother, my dear friend, my ex-wife, you know, I saw what relapse looks like, and it's hard for me to stand here and say thank God that that happened to them, because for me, seeing that makes me realize that I don't ever want to go back there again, you know? And when it's right in your face with someone that you love and you care about so much, it's something that you really don't ever want to go back to. So spirituality is a big part of my life today. I do my morning meditations. I do my readings. I get to meetings as often as I can. I don't do it as regularly as I should. You know, one of the things that my first sponsor told me to do was 90 meetings in 90 days. And I did that. 3 times in a row. And it's like, I'm at a meeting every night. You know, 9 months. So, okay, I just continued. And I got involved. This again might date me a little bit, but my sponsor said, clean up the ashtrays, put away the chairs, you know, because you'd walk into a basement like this back in the day and there'd be probably this much smoke. And if you ever were at the Alano Club, you know what I'm talking about in Waukesha. So, but, you know, he told me to get involved, you know, secretary of meeting. And then I got involved with the area. I was a Unity chair for NA, and what I did was I put on functions. I raised the funds for the area, and I got involved at the area level. Those meetings were awesome. Robert's Rules of Order, yes. But it kept me there. I looked at what the people that were staying clean and sober did, and I tried to emulate that as best I could. You know, I mean, the way that I've got clean, I wouldn't wish upon anybody. The way that I do it, I wouldn't wish upon anybody. But, you know, I worked the steps. I did my four step with my sponsor. And I went to him after I thought that I'd been thorough. And he looked at it a little bit and said, Rusty, you can do better than this. So I went back and wrote some more. And I did my fifth with him. And when we were done, we went out to his backyard, and he had a grill, and we lit it up, and he said, hang on to what you need, and let go of what you don't anymore, and, you know, and go from there. He said, there might be stuff that you let go and you take back, and you let go and you take back, but, you know, when it's time, you'll let go of all those character defects that you don't need anymore. And I did. So with that, you know, I'm kind of drawn a blank. So one of the things that, like I said, that I do is I do my morning meditations. I'd like to read the one that I have that I read today. It's from A New Day, July 11th. Live near to God, so all things will appear to you little in comparison with eternal realities. Am I too busy to take 15 minutes from my day to communicate with God? If my answer is yes, then I can't afford not to take the time, because that's when I probably need it most. I've learned that if I'm not careful, a continually stressful schedule can cause me to feel separated from God. In time, this hinders my spiritual growth. What happens when I reorder my priorities and set aside time for prayer and meditation? Almost immediately, I feel a sense of peace and calmness, knowing that God is with me and I no longer need to rely solely on my own resources. Because I am open myself to Him, I am far more likely to receive His guidance. It may not come during my actual period of meditation, but experience has taught me that it will come at some point, either in the form of a special inspiration that seemingly comes out of nowhere, or as an intuitive feeling deep within me. When I take the time to communicate with God, I am refreshed and renewed. My day begins anew, and it's likely that I'll be more successful at what I'm doing. Thought for today, when you're too busy for prayer and meditation, that's probably when you need it most. And today, I do my prayers and I do my meditation, and I have more of an attitude of gratitude. I've gone through a lot, and I've had a lot of things. I've lost a lot of things. But the one thing that I do know, and that I can share with you, is that no matter how bad you think it is, you can get through it clean and sober. You can. I'm living proof. I've gone through some stuff that I've gone through divorce, you know, and one of the things, if you hang around long enough, this program is going to take some of your outs, because it did for me. You know, it's like, well, if something happens, if my brother passes, my mom, my a kid, you know, and I've had friends in the program who, you know, I had a friend, his mother passed away, and that night he's at a meeting. It's like, dang it, took that one away from me, you know? So, and it's happened, you know? And I realized today that it doesn't matter how bad it gets. My God didn't bring me along this far to just drop me and leave me, you know? No matter how bad it gets, it's gonna be okay. It could always be worse. It could always be worse. So one of the things my first sponsor used to say to me when I'd call him up during the day, going through some, you know, early recovery stuff, it was all crazy and, oh, this is killing me. He's like, Rusty, are you clean today? And I knew it was coming. I was like, yeah, I'm clean. Then it's a great day. And I was like, oh. So let me ask you, are you clean today?
Yes.
Then it's a great day. Yes. With that, I pass.